It's KUOW's The Record. Welcome to Monday. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter, you know, at KUOW. If you have looked at Amazon.com today, you know the first thing you see is their click-through menu for Cyber Monday deals. Cyber Monday. Analysts say Americans will spend hundreds of millions of dollars shopping online today, and Amazon will get a chunk of that money. But we're not going to talk about the economics of Cyber Monday right now. We are here to talk about how you feel when you shop at Amazon. Our next guest says he learned about a specific emotion connected to using Amazon instead of a brick-and-mortar store. And that emotion is guilt. Joshua McNichols, co-host of the KUOW podcast Primed. Welcome, Joshua.
Hey, Bill.
You and your host, Carolyn Adolph, heard from people who have had this Amazon guilt. What do they tell you about it? Where does the guilt come from?
Well, we first became aware of it because people were talking about these feelings on our Primed Facebook page. They were saying, oh, I shop at Amazon all the time. I feel guilty about it.
But I do it anyway.
But I do it anyway. And it seems like it comes from three different places. One is this idea that Amazon is killing jobs, retail jobs that people value. Another thing is concern for the environment. People say, well, there's so much fuel expended in the shipping and the cardboard and packaging and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And the third thing is they feel sometimes that there's a loss of a threat to their personal connection with mom and pop retailers that they may know in their own community.
Yes. And you say in the course of this Primed episode that the reality is more complicated. Big box retail stores, mom and pop stores, those have different experiences from Amazon's success.
Yes, very different experiences.
Yeah. So let's start with the big box stores then. Has Amazon killed those giants?
Well, this is one of the places where it's a lot more complicated than we'd think. And maybe we can be absolved of some of our guilt, at least when it comes to, you know, big box stores like Sears. I mean, one thing that happened, there was this period when there was sort of this idea that all wealth was sort of moving to the suburbs. And so there was a lot of investment in big box stores to be near this suburban wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we got to this point where eventually we know that flipped, right? The wealth is accumulating in cities now, and suburbs have... There are some wealthy suburbs, but there are also some areas where people who can't afford to live in the city are living in the suburbs now. Somehow that flipped. The recession played a role, but we became oversaturated with big box stores. And because there was this intense competition between these stores like Sears and JCPenney and Kmart, they took out these loans to be able to compete with each other. And they took on a bunch of debt. And today, they're actually doing fairly well in terms of their revenues, but they're not able to overcome the massive weight of the debt, which is hanging around their necks like an albatross.
So not all Amazon's fault. Although not everyone even feels that big a sentimental connection to Sears or JCPenney. Anyway, some do, I suppose.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so now let's talk about the smaller retail stores. Did you find that shopping at Amazon hurts those smaller retail stores?
Well, it does in many cases, but it has also forced them to adapt. I mean, one thing that is hard for Amazon to offer is experiences. That sort of personal connection that people feel with their mom and pop stores. You no longer go to these stores to buy a commodity. You know, it's like...
Mm-hmm. You can get that anywhere.
You can get underwear anywhere, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, you have to get it. You can't actually get it. You can't get it at a mom and pop store. You have to go
online
or to a big box store.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody feels sentimental about the loss of Sears or something, except for the jobs. But but that's not why you go to a small brick and mortar store in your neighborhood today. I mean, if you want to buy... You know, it's almost an artisan experience, you know, to go buy something. I went to, Sonic Boom, the record store, where you can sort of flip through records. It's that physical experience. It's that having sort of a treasure hunt, you know, when you go there. All these things are part of what it means to be a small mom and pop retail today. But, you know, that's also sort of a... It's sort of a privileged position to be able to those experiences become a little bit more expensive too, right?
Yes, that's right. So yeah, if you can afford it, then that's okay. So these local retailers maybe are being forced to, and maybe they're even enjoying providing an experience for their customers. So do the local mom and pops tell us that we should feel guilty about shopping at Amazon?
Yeah, it's kind of we kind of hear a mixed message from them. Some of them, for example, at at Sonic Boom, Kay Redden, who works there, thought, you know what? We really need more guilt, more Amazon guilt in this world, because that would drive people to my store. If they really thought about their purchases and supporting their local retailer, they would come to me, right? But on the other hand, the owner of Sonic Boom says, wait a minute. I talked to him a little later, and he said, you know, I knew she was going to talk to you guys. I hope she didn't say anything too bad, because every day Amazon workers get off the bus right outside my store, and they come in and they buy my records.
So not from their employer, but at this place where they're having an experience.
Exactly.
Some surprise finds.
So, I mean, it shows the sort of like double-edged, I don't know, it's not maybe not a double-edged sword, but it's like in this town in particular, we benefit from some of the economic redistribution of wealth that has allowed people to pay for these sort of experiences at traditional brick and mortars.
Yes, yeah, that's a good way to put it. So you also mentioned the environmental concerns around shopping and shipping. And you dug into that for your Primed podcast episode. What did you find out?
Yeah, well, it's kind of fascinating that, you know, we have this kind of gut sense that it's got to be worse for the environment to be ordering things online. And what we found is that it's actually more nuanced than that. In many ways, it's actually better, simply because, you know, when you think about it, a company like Amazon is constantly thinking about cutting down their prices in terms of shipping. And although their motivation is economic, it does have an impact in terms of how much fuel they consume. They're constantly looking at, like, I went to one of the Amazon warehouses and a worker was packing these trucks full of boxes, you know, and like a wall of boxes. It was like Tetris, you know, getting as many boxes as she possibly could. That is highly efficient. However, there is a limitation on that. There are a couple of limitations. Number one, if you don't recycle your cardboard, that's a bad thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But number two, if you order the free two-day shipping, what ends up happening is that more of these trucks end up going empty or half empty from location to location. Basically, the more you limit Amazon or another online retailer's time to think about how to process your order most efficiently, the more environmental cost there is to that.
I see. And I would think I'd much rather have them ship by road, especially when trucks become more electric, than I would have them flying through the air. Right. That's got a huge impact.
I know, but so many people are Prime members and they offer this free two-day shipping. There's this interesting Vox article on this, and one thing they recommended at the end is that, you know, so Amazon does offer you a discount if you choose not to do the
quickest shipping, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so, but it's really tempting when you see that there to choose the free two-day. But Vox suggested that maybe they should call it like green shipping, right? And it's not gonna. Plus you get a discount.
Yeah.
And then it's like if they could sell it that way, maybe more people would choose that. You know?
Okay. So if you feel guilty about the environmental impact of your Amazon shopping, one thing you could do is plan ahead so you don't need quote unquote need that thing, that package in 2 days.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, a little side note, Joshua. I didn't. You mentioned got to recycle your cardboard. I did an intro. I break them down and I tear off the tape because the tape can't be recyclable, right? And I talked to this recycling expert who said, "Don't worry about that. You can throw in a box, tape and all, and it'll all come out okay in the recycling wash." So,
right.
Okay, small thing. All right, talking with Joshua McNichols, who co-hosts our podcast, Primed, about the whole Amazon experience, personal, municipal, all of that. And bottom line, Joshua, would you say that based on what you've learned, I should or should not feel guilty about shopping at Amazon?
Well, it depends on what your values are, but it also depends on it depends on what you buy. And it depends, like, if it's something that that you could get at a local retailer and you want to support that local business, you know, maybe there's a reason, maybe you should feel guilty, because that guilt is a clue to us that we need to go out and do something, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to, you know, some of these other things, we may be making some assumptions that aren't always true. When it comes to the environment, the answer is more nuanced. When it comes to, jobs and big box retailers, you know, the answer is more nuanced. I mean, some of what's happening with these other big box retailers, it's kind of like the gods are wrestling sort of above us. And they're like falling on the ground and putting up mountain ranges with their backs. And here we are on the ground saying stuff like, oh my gosh, I kind of feel guilty because, you know, for this or that minor thing that I did as a mere mortal, but, you know. We're That's just a great playing point. On the field of the gods.
Yes, yes, the mixed martial arts of the gods. What's the next episode of Primed? What are you working on?
Well, we want to find out who's working at Amazon. We want to find out what it's like to work at the headquarters. I mean, there's some really fascinating jobs that are there that aren't necessarily programmer jobs, you know, or programmer jobs if you're one of the, you know, smaller number of women who get these jobs. But for example, you know, I had a friend who's a writer, and she was saying, you know, my book wasn't doing so, you know, I've got this memoir that I'm working on, but I think maybe where I'm going to get my bread and butter is go to write for Alexa, right? Because there's this sort of, there's positions for people who basically write Easter eggs. They write these little jokes. There's even a newsletter that comes out regularly of like things you can ask Alexa that give you sort of funny answers. And there are humans who are writers, sometimes comedy writers, who, you know, who produce that content. Or there's, I heard about another person whose job is basically to, when somebody walks in a room with an outfit on, and their job is to say, that's fashionable, or that's in poor taste. And they're basically, they're in a room with a bunch of other people who are doing that. When 85% of the people like the outfit, it's a check mark.
That's
right?
A go.
You build a database of this stuff, and that teaches Alexa to, you know, through neural networks and algorithmic learning to sort of, to make judgments about your outfit. So you can walk in a room with an outfit in front of Alexa and say, Alexa, how do you like my outfit, right? So these are the kinds of unique jobs. But on the other hand, these are sort of creative class jobs. These are good paying jobs. On the other hand, there's fulfillment centers too, where, you know, they don't pay as much. There isn't as much economic mobility. You know, we're wondering what that's like. We were talking to Amazon, and they're saying, well, we know that there's not a lot of economic mobility there, so we're trying to help them by, you know, providing them with educational opportunities. We're paying tuition so that people can train to become nurses and stuff if they work at the fulfillment center long enough. So we want to dig into that.
You know who's listening to you right now?
Who?
Besides the Amazon Echo, who I'm not going to name, so I won't set it off. Amazon employees are listening to you, and former employees are listening to you. What if they want to talk to you or your co-host, Carolyn? How should they reach you?
Oh, they can
tell their story.
Many different ways. I forgot to bring the Primed email address, so you can just write jmcnichols@kuow.org, and I'll make sure the team gets it, and we'd love to follow up with you.
Very good. Joshua McNichols, the co-host of Primed, a KUOW podcast about what happens when Amazon comes to your town. You can find all the episodes on our website, KUOW.org, or wherever you listen to your podcast. Joshua, great to talk with you. Thanks.
Great to talk to you.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. I'm glad you've tuned in today. We're tweeting at KUOW. A 42-year-old man is having a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl. He tells her she should date boys her own age.
Have you been seeing someone?
No. Yes, someone older. I mean, you know, not as old as I am, but in the same general ballpark as me.
That's Woody Allen and Mariel Hemingway in the movie Manhattan. There are a lot of former Woody Allen fans who will never watch Manhattan again. And that was just compounded last month when Allen talked about sexual assault in the entertainment industry, and he warned of a modern witch hunt where, quote, every guy in an office who winks at a woman is suddenly having to call a lawyer to defend himself. My next guest does still watch Woody Allen films. Like Allen, Claire Dieterer is a writer and perhaps a monster, as she wrote in the Paris Review. Good to see you again, Claire. Thanks for coming.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
First off, why are you still not only watching, but paying to watch the work of Woody Allen and Roman Polanski? Why, Claire?
Why would I stop?
Why would you stop? Well, obviously you could stop because you would be rewarding or enabling that artist.
Right. I think it's easy to jump on a kind of, I don't want to say bandwagon, because we're in this incredibly important historic moment. This moment when people are coming forward and saying things, you know, sharing what has happened to them, sharing these accusations, really feeling emboldened, women feeling emboldened to say difficult, difficult things that have happened. I can't, it's incredible. It's an experience of a lifetime. So to, you know, it's not just a cultural moment, it's something bigger. We're in this moment where people are really struggling with this stuff. At the same time, artists have always done, well, you know, crappy things. There have always been badly behaved artists. It's been, it's the case forever. And do we throw out all the art from the last two millennia that was made by monsters? I'm not sure that we do. And certainly for me, I don't. And that's a decision I've made for myself.
Okay, well, throwing out all the work of the last couple millennia is a big climb. What about just not watching or paying to watch a Woody Allen film? There's certainly plenty of other filmmakers out there. And as I said, you could imagine someone not wanting to either reward or enable him. I hear this all the time.
I hear it all the time, too. Okay. I've been thinking about this for a long time. I actually started writing about this issue of whether or not we watch, and more importantly to me, how we watch the work of monsters. I've been working on it for a couple of years. And I think that's one of the reasons I wrote this essay for the Paris Review, as you mentioned, and it's really struck a chord. And I think one of the reasons it's struck a chord is because I've been thinking about it in this really kind of exhausting, thorough way previous to the Weinstein allegations. And there's a lot of, my approach to it has a lot of nuance and not a lot of reactivity because I'm not just starting to think about it now.
Yes.
I started this essay like a year or two ago, and I've been struggling with the legacy of especially Roman Polanski for several years.
Who you know a lot about. See, there's one thing. If you don't know a lot about the artist, it might be easier to not find out more.
Right. And so this is the Woody Allen problem. Like, I know a lot about him. I love his work. When I was a little kid, I would watch his films and I always felt really close to him. I had a sense of identification with him. He seemed sort of, he has a kind of little kid-like quality in his on-screen persona, if you can see that. He's intellectual, but he's also a little bit powerless.
Yes.
And he's also a little kind of befuddled by the world,
yep.
Which is how kids feel.
Yeah.
So I had a strong sense of identification. And for me, when the Sun Yi news came out, I felt really personally betrayed.
This was his adopted daughter.
No, it was his longtime partner, Mia Farrow's adoptive daughter.
Right.
And
he never adopted her. But in any case, he raised her. He was.
Well, no, they didn't live together. So he, you know, this is part of the
feedback
you get on this from the Woody Allen defenders, right?
I didn't know I was defending him, but I am curious about the details.
Right. So he was in a long time sort of boyfriend girlfriend relationship with Mia. Some call it a companionate relationship, some don't. But they were involved and his partner's daughter or adoptive daughter, though that adoptive seems so dismissive. It was her daughter. She adopted her, was Sun Yi Previn. And Woody Allen became involved with her when she was a teenager. And of course, they're married now. And Woody
Allen. Have been for a long time.
A long time. And Woody Allen also made the film Manhattan, in which he, as you just played the clip from, has his character, the character that is fictional but portrayed by him, has a relationship with actually a high schooler, not just a teenage girl, but a girl who is in high school. So there's this really disturbing conflation of his life and his art in that particular film. So for me, Woody Allen, I had loved him so much. And when he had the relationship with Sun Yi, I did feel really betrayed by him. I just felt like he had been someone I identified with, and suddenly he was a predator. You know, he was somebody who had preyed upon a young girl. And yet, to me, as somebody who loves film and is a former film critic and also is just sort of desperate to find great art, which I don't think is such a common thing, his work is so important and so beautiful. And so over the last year, I went back and I tried to watch the films and sort of see how they held up with our new intense awareness about the sexual politics we've all been talking about over the last year, the despair we're all feeling within, well, many of us are feeling within this administration and so forth. So first I watched Annie Hall, which is his Academy Award-winning film, the only comedy that's ever won the Best Picture Award, and it is still beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good. I had a couple moments of guilt about giving him my money, but at the same time, I was totally drawn into the story and into like Annie's clothes and into the charming banter and to the beautiful Manhattan scenes, and I could do it. Then I went to watch Manhattan, which is his film about his relationship with a teenager, and it was unwatchable. It was completely intolerable. And I think it's
because... But why unwatchable? So... I haven't seen Manhattan in so many years, but I think I can watch it and notice all the things you noticed in your piece about how he doesn't, Woody Allen, the character, the writer, does or doesn't seem to grapple with the implications of this relationship. I can watch that and think those things. And what's wrong with that? Why, as an artist yourself, aren't you wary about putting up a line saying, thou shalt not?
I don't think I'm saying that shalt not at all. I think I'm saying I tried to engage with the work. And for me, as someone who has, you know, survived, though that word's so melodramatic, but I've survived many instances of sexual assault, certainly as a teenager from predatory older men, which I think is, you know, we're finding is this universal experience for women, or certainly very widespread. Mm-hmm. For me, it was very unsettling, both as someone who'd gone through it and as the mother of a teenager myself. But what I get at, or try to get at in the piece I wrote for the Paris Review, is for me, every case is something I reapproach with a freshness. I'm just trying to sort of see what it's like to try to consume art in the context of this monstrousness, but I don't have an idea of how anybody ought to do it. Yeah. And you asked, why draw a line? Well, in fact, I feel like I do the opposite of that. I don't draw a bright line at all. I feel like, from my point of view, each of us is the audience. You're the audience. I'm the audience individually. And we're making these decisions all the time. And the last thing I want to do is say, we ought to do this or we ought to do that. I'm really pushing against that idea.
Yeah, yeah, true. I want to get a reaction to, we put this up on Facebook and had people talk about it. And Carla says, Stephen Colbert put it best, your reaction to their work is a personal thing that you can't necessarily turn on or off. If their behavior has ruined it for you, it's been ruined. There is no should. And you're reacting, you're putting your hands on your heart. But what about a should? What about, I get back to the idea that you can, if you want to, turn it off. You can say, I enjoy listening to a Chuck Berry song or watching a Woody Allen movie or Bill Cosby or whatever, but I'm going to turn on my should, and I'm going to tell other people, no, but listen, the only reason we know what Woody Allen said about a witch hunt atmosphere is because the BBC interviewed Woody Allen because he's still relevant, and isn't that partly because people still go to see his movies? Why not a boycott? Even a very self-aware boycott.
Okay, I'm getting two messages from you. Okay. Are you saying we should draw a bright line against watching the films, or we should obey the idea of the biographical fallacy, which asks us to separate the life from the work? You sort of addressed both those ideas in your last statement. Which one?
Take your favorite. That's just poor interviewing skills, but let's work
didn't
through
need
them.
To call you out, man. I feel like it's been really interesting engaging with this because it is often, as I say in my piece, men who are the ones who are the most eager to promulgate this theory that we should separate life and art. And I feel very much, I mean, who doesn't love to say this? I feel very much as Stephen Colbert does, which is that even if we want to separate those two things, that's not necessarily what happens. So as I write in my piece, just because someone thinks that Woody Allen's biography shouldn't matter doesn't achieve the objective of making it not matter.
Right.
For a whole lot of people who are watching these films, it matters. What I'm saying is within that, we can have the freedom to choose or not choose to watch the films and acknowledge that the films are going to be disturbed by our knowledge of the biography. And that's a fact. It's just we're going to watch Annie Hall and know we have complex feelings about this man, or watch Manhattan and have even more complex feelings and not pretend otherwise. And that acknowledging the feelings that come up with the knowledge of the biography is okay. We don't have to make logical decisions all the time.
Then maybe this is too logical a question. Do you have a line where would something happen that you would never consume somebody's art again? That's it. I'm out.
What about you?
My first reaction is no. But I don't say that in a lectury way of the kind that was in your Paris Review article. You talk about males kind of lecturing you like, just judge the work on its artistic aesthetic merit, Claire. You know, and I'm not saying that, but you can tell me, does my reaction, my general reaction, as I said, that I can I don't know why I would watch a Cosby show again, but I could listen to an old record that I laughed at when I was a kid about Bill Cosby and, you know, his the monsters that I don't know how much Bill Cosby you know, but back, I was a big fan when I was a kid. So, but I think I can listen to that stuff, watch that stuff, and by someone I think I would never let around my daughters. And I think I could do that. Is that wrong?
And still laugh.
And still laugh, I think.
Well, and I think that's personal. That's what I'm trying to say over and over. We each get to decide. For me, I mean, clearly, writing about women and feminism is just essential to who I am. I'm a feminist writer. I'm a feminist memoirist. This is the perspective I'm coming from. And yet, I love Roman Polanski. I love his films. They're really important to me. I know everything he's done. I wrote a memoir, Love and Trouble, that came out last spring, and I write about Roman Polanski a lot in it because it's about the predatory sexual environment of the 1970s, which I experienced in the most unpleasant way. Well, not the most unpleasant way, but that was something that I had to make my way through. And I took Roman Polanski as this kind of totem figure of that time. So I researched him very completely. And the more I researched him, it was almost as though it wasn't I liked him. I also watched his films in order to research him, and they did not lose their power. I still watch those films, and I still pay for them. I don't go to a friend's house. I don't download them for free.
You're paying for Chinatown.
Yeah, and yet not only do I know what he did, I experienced assault as a young woman, a very, very young pre-teenager in the 1970s. So I identify with the story of his victim, Samantha Gailey. I wasn't raped, but he raped this 13-year-old girl, if you don't know his story. Mm-hmm. I know the whole story, and yet somehow I'm able to watch those films and love them. They're important to me. And so I guess I fall more on the side you're talking about. I don't know if I could still find Cosby funny. I haven't applied.
Yeah, I don't know either. That's true.
And I'm very eager and interested to apply that test to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And the Louis C.K. situation is something, I do want to go back and watch those specials and see what they look like now.
You'll pay for them.
What's that?
You'll pay for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here, I'm talking with Claire Dieterer, who wrote this essay in the Paris Review. And we've talked about watching movies and TV shows by people you call monsters. Maybe we'll have time to talk about the word monster, too. But you widen this out. You get beyond that and talk about a couple of big things. Number one, you say that when you were upset at Woody Allen, you were not thinking, you were feeling, and that we all do that. Why is that an important difference?
I think that we are, I started that with I think. We're often told that when it comes to asking ethical questions that we should foreground logic.
Yeah.
But I think that we come to ethical problems with feelings. I think that a lot of times we're telling ourselves we're thinking ethically when what we're really doing is feeling morally. And when I first realized that, it seemed problematic to me. But the longer I think about it, the more I realize it's not problematic. We're allowed to have moral feelings when we think about Woody Allen having sex with his partner's she was 19 is what we know, teenage daughter. We're allowed to have moral feelings about Roman Polanski anally raping a 13-year-old. Am I allowed to say that on the radio? Those are feelingful situations. And the problem is when we take those moral feelings and we put this sort of carapace of ethical language around them and start to tell everybody else what they ought to do or think. I'm troubled by what happens when we pretend that feeling is not occurring. And I feel
what happens?
Well, we're in it. I mean, this is the landscape we live in now, is we're surrounded by a bunch of moral feelers who are speaking as though they ethically know best. I mean, we're all doing it's happening all around us all the time.
Are you talking about politicians now?
I am.
I am. Yeah, I vibed with that because I know that I do that too. Mm-hmm. I feel morally instead of thinking. And well, when I do, see, I don't think of my watching a movie based on that moral feeling as very high stakes. But I do think when I'm having righteous anger at someone in my family, or, you know, I could give you lots of situations. Those are the times when I do try to pull back and remind myself that I have told a story about myself and a story about them. And that could be, you know, if I'm how my feelings about Donald Trump or my father or the tech support worker or whatever is still my own psychodrama.
Well, I want to know more about the tech support worker. What's going on there?
What did they ever do to me?
I think that what makes this a fascinating question and the reason that it keeps opening up, at least for me, is that it's a continuum. Mm-hmm. You start to ask a question about, do I download a Woody Allen film, or, you know, am I going to, you know, kind of Blue by Miles Davis? He wasn't, you know, exactly an angel. Am I going to download that album? And then it starts to lead into, well, I'm downloading it onto my iPhone, and I know that's wrong, and I love to watch the Seahawks, and we all have complicated feelings about the NFL and how, you know, the health of their players and whether or not that's protected, or, you know, it just goes on and on, and then it goes into personal relationships and politics. So I do think it's a continuum that, and, you know, what we're going to eat and how we're going to eat, these moral and ethical questions, we're answering them all day long, consciously or not, but they're sort of poking at us. And I think that this experience over the last month for all of us with after the Weinstein accusations has brought those kinds of questions to the fore in an interesting way. But I don't think it just stops at sexual politics.
You also get into the question of whether all artists are monstrous in some way, and that includes my guest, Claire Dieterer. Why is that important? What are you wrestling with there?
Well, before I ask, in this essay that I wrote that we keep referring to, before I ask if all artists are monsters, I deal with the idea that all people have some monstrousness in them, and that there might be some quality when we look at a monster who's in our midst of self-recognition, you know, that we see something in ourselves that we don't like. So there's sort of a more general idea that, you know, we all have a dark side. But when it comes to an artist, what I'm asking is really, and this is, you know, this is an old question, is there something about being a maker or a creator and making something great that requires monstrousness? And if you are not monstrous enough, can you make something great? And that's sort of where I go with the essay, is just wondering, well, if I haven't written something great, is it because I'm not selfish enough? Is it because I don't take enough for myself?
And give examples of why the art of being a successful, prolific artist who finishes, you talk about that, you finish your work, that there's something selfish and or monstrous about that.
Yeah, I write about, in the piece I write about how the great artist is the finisher. It's the person who, you know, many of us start works all the time. It's the completing of...
I've started several.
Yeah.
I have an anthology.
Right, I'm starting one right now. It's the completing that makes you the artist. And if you're going to complete, there's what I call a lot of little savageries that have to happen. There's the shutting the door against your mate. There's the, you know, ignoring your children. There's the promises unkept. There's the not calling your parents back. There's all those little shutting out the world moments. And also there's the belief in your own point of view and in saying what you have to say that involves a certain sort of mental shutting out of the world. All of that takes a kind of, it's not monstrosity like perhaps anally raping a 13-year-old, but there is a way in which you do need to foreground your own needs and your own desires as a worker. And that particular kind of anti-nurturing, you know, not doing the work of taking care of everyone else, is in particular among the women I know very difficult. You know, when I talk to other women writers and artists, that dynamic of being a longtime working artist is very hard.
How much are you saying that message comes from within, this idea that you're either a nurturer or a monster? And how much is that what you've been told?
Well, I don't know. I think that that's something that has been really, for me, one of the, this sounds funny, but one of the joys of the last few months has been this very open discussion we've all been having about internalized patriarchy and internalized self-hatred as a woman. That's become a very common thing to talk about. And I think that that conversation has acknowledged that what's out there has gone in here. And it's hard to know the difference for a lot of women. And that's been that this whole dialogue, or the post-Weinstein dialogue, that's been one of the comforts for me, is women acknowledging that there's a lot of internalized censorship and self-editing that's been occurring because of this sort of ambient hostile relationship.
Can I come back to something you said at the very beginning of this conversation? You said basically, what are we going to do, throw out 2 millennia of great artists, great works?
Yeah.
What if we did? I mean, what if we did make really, of course, we don't know the private lives of all these artists, but when we do find out about them, what if we tore down those metaphorical statues of all of those artists? It's not like there aren't other people contributing, you know, and we just, yeah, we threw out the work of 2 millennia of great artists. What about that?
Oh my God, Bill, we're starting a utopia right now.
Right, it starts right here, Claire.
Right now, I love it.
You fill that vacuum, Claire. Instead of listening to a Wagner symphony, I was reading Claire
Dieterer.
Well, that's
how it works. It's the dichotomy, Claire Dieterer or listening to a Wagner.
I cut Wagner loose so I could make space in my life for you.
Good choice. Good choices. I think that there's actually, we're joking, but I think there is some truth in that. I think that when we cut away some of the, I do think that we can use this moment to talk about the fact that there are so many voices that haven't been heard. Female voices, all kinds of other voices that we can talk about making space for and talk about making support for. But, I mean, maybe I'm just, you know, relentlessly realistic, but that work is there. And we don't throw it out. It's there and it's beautiful. And I don't know about you, but I don't get to encounter great art or great works that much. And I don't want to throw out the ones I have. I just don't. I'd be sad.
You might get over it.
Maybe I would. Maybe when we live in this utopia.
Yeah.
Okay. You've convinced me.
All right. Get the U-Haul. We're moving to utopia. That's Claire Dieterer, who wrote in the Paris Review. What was the title? The Art of Monstrous Men.
What are we going to do with the art of monstrous men?
Yeah. By the way, monster. I never call anybody a monster. Isn't that distancing? You know, it's like then they're other people. Your whole essay was about not distancing, but what if we just stopped calling people monsters and started calling them human complex, exploitive? Let's be specific.
There's something kind of badass about a monster.
Uh-huh.
And Jenny Offel writes about this in her amazing novel, Department of Speculation, which I quote in the piece. She talks about art monsters,
mm-hmm.
who are basically men who get women to do stuff for them so that they can spend their time making art.
Right.
And she talks about this sort of as something women aspire to. I'd love to be an art monster.
I wish I had a wife.
Yeah, exactly. And this idea that you sort of use the people around you in order to do your work. And the joke is, of course, that you won't. You would never use in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But borrowing a little monstrousness might not be such a bad thing for female artists.
Okay, fair enough. Claire Dieterer and Love and Trouble is your
Love
latest
and Trouble.
Book? Yeah, so read that too if you enjoyed the Paris Review essay and this conversation. Claire, thanks a lot. Good to talk with you again.
Thank you for having me. It was great to be here.
It's KUOW's The Record. We're going to be right back. KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle is one of the whitest cities in America, and both Jen Peterson and Audra Boo are feeling that whiteness. Jen worked at KEXP and was the general manager at the Cloud Room on Capitol Hill. Audra Boo is a musician and actor. They're both black women who've lived in Seattle for years. The presidential election last year shook them both, and for Jen Peterson, it was the end of her time here. When I talked with them a year ago, Jen told me why she decided to leave Seattle and the United States.
We live in a beautiful city, but I've been here since 92, and I've seen exponential change. And not that change is a bad thing. I'm not throwing my hands up and crying in a corner. It's sort of now a rock in my river. It's not flowing like it used to here.
How do you know you can make that internal change by changing your external surroundings?
You know, that's a good question, and I don't know yet. I feel it. I want to watch this from afar. I don't want my money to stimulate this economy. I hate to say that, but it's true. And I have a lot of friends that are saying, you know, stay, fight the fight. That fight isn't new. And those who think it's new, I get it. I understand. I get you. You got a long road ahead of you, but it's a fight that we fought for a very long time.
We haven't really talked specifically about what it is that you aren't liking about Seattle now.
Being a woman in the workforce and having been afforded the opportunities that I've had, working the places that I've had, they've all been wonderful and great experiences. But again, I'm civic minded and I like numbers. And currently, and it might even be worse now, but Seattle is currently 7% black people, and 3% of those black people are employed. So people like Audra and I are unicorns when we walk into places like this as the workforce. I'm always one of one, one of two.
Will you talk about what that means to you and why that's important?
I realized when I went to Brooklyn for the first Afropunk, I sat on a bench, and I should have been watching bands. But I didn't know what I was in for. I sat on the bench and watched beautiful black people walk past me, and it still gives me goosebumps from my head to my toe. And I realized that I wasn't seeing that when I came back. And every time I would touch down in Seattle and I tell you this story, I cry. I get upset. And it takes me a minute to acclimate back to who I am here, because I feel black there, and I love it.
What's your experience?
When we're speaking about blackness, you know, taking it back, like, yeah, we went to Brooklyn this year. It was me and a bunch of our friends who had never been to Afropunk. And I was only there just for the days of the festival. And immediately walking into the festival, there is the realization, the undoubted realization that this is not even all the black people in the city that we are in. When you walk into Afropunk, there are just all the shades of black and brown that you could ever imagine, right? And I've not left the country by plane, we'll say, like, you know, Europe or any of those places, Africa. I've been Canada, Mexico. That's my reach. Going to Brooklyn and seeing all these black and brown faces, I immediately bust into tears, mm-hmm. and would proceed to spend a lot of the weekend in tears just at the realization. There was a whole other festival going on. Was it Brooklyn Loves MJ that Spike Lee put on, mm-hmm. at the same time? And there's black people there and they're not even the same. It's a profound experience to go somewhere. And I don't even have to count. I don't have to think about it. Mm-mm. Here, in Seattle, like, I'm from here. I'm born and raised here. I love Seattle too. But here, I'm always taking count how many other black people are in the same space as me. Who else is in the room?
Some people listening know exactly what you mean, and some people might want to know, help me understand, why is it so important, the number of, so there's a lot of black people here, few black people here. Why is it so important to you?
Equity
Yeah.
Equity, not equality, equity, you know, is so important here. And the numbers are staggering. You see me just sit up, right? The numbers are staggering here. Seattle is 66% white, and 51% of those white people are men. You know, it's put it on that level, just right there for me. And you have to count. And it's not even that you have to, it's just that you do. You know, you walk into a room, and when Audra said that, I was like, yep, that happens innately in you in Seattle. You walk in, you're like, oh, one. you know, I'm the only person here. And you expect certain things. You know, you have to, you do that because you have to guard yourself.
Especially when you're a musician, a musician of color in Seattle, and how the changing landscape has made me realize more and more that I am sometimes the only black person in the room. As the country is turning in a direction, as being black is becoming so much harder, it just makes me look at who I'm in spaces with and what's the reception and how much of my actual self do I get to really be. Mm-hmm. And that has been, that alone has been, for me, really difficult. I just did a Nina Simone tribute night at Teatro Zanzani. And this was right after the election. And, you know, I knew that social media was going to explode. My black and brown Facebook going crazy, right? And it just, I was like, okay, I'm just gonna like, ooh, I'm gonna try to keep it strong. I'm gonna try to just, you know, I'm not confrontational and I don't like to do politics. And it was so hard to remain mellow about what the future looks like. So, you know, I had a lot of problems with, even at this tribute, like Teatro Zanzani is a, it is a predominantly white crowd. And I was singing Young, Gifted, and Black right after Whitney Monge's song Strange Fruit in a crowd where I only spotted two black faces that were in chairs.
How did that make you feel?
Oh, dude, that was rough. That's rough. I've never, this is the, this, these last few years and really more these last months having to realize my blackness in white spaces, it's been tough. And when you add on to that, that I am a mother of two black children. And just ever since the 13-year-old in the park with the toy gun. The cops didn't even get out the car.
Tamir Rice in Cleveland.
Yes. 13. My son is 13. And it is every day in my mind that, like, being black, not only in Seattle, but all over the place, is a constant thing that we have to think about. I can't just wake up and just have my day. I don't have the privilege to do that.
You both mentioned that you were unhappy about the Trump election. There might be people listening who aren't black saying, we're not black, but we're liberal. We didn't vote for Trump. Seattle is liberal and embracing, and we love diversity, and, you know.
Let's start showing it.
Tell me your experience.
You know what? Proof is in the pudding. If people want to say that, I need you to come from a space of actually knowing that that's happening. Put yourself, don't tell yourself that it's happening because you have a black friend. Don't tell yourself that it's happening because you went to a Nina Simone tribute. Don't tell yourself it's happening if it's not happening. There's no gray area there for me, honestly.
What's your experience? You're saying that you don't see it, that's just talk. What do you see?
I mean, as much as it can happen, it does happen, sure. I say open up more doors. Keep your head up more. If you really think it's happening, think again. Do more if you think it's happening. Find out where it's happening. Create spaces for it to happen. Most importantly, create those comfortable, safe spaces for it to happen. And yes, we are a liberal city, but let's start being it. you know, people used to say that we're passive aggressive. We're becoming more aggressive. I want to find my own way, somewhere else. Like Audra said, I never used to be so political, but I do worry daily now. And I worry for my friends. I worry for my family. I think it was right before the last debate. I was driving down I-5 and there were three gray planes that were parked at Boeing Field. And mind you, these gray planes were probably there just to get painted, you know, like Boeing or 777 or whatever. But the thought in my head was those are for us, meaning those are to take those black people from Seattle and ship them somewhere. And I know it's not true. It's just the first thought that came into my mind and it has stayed and I'm ready for that anxiety to go.
I'll tell you this. I'm not leaving. I'm not going anywhere. Me and my fiance, we just bought a house. And I have kids here and I'm not going anywhere. I want to build and to have a foundation here that I can be proud of, that I worked for, that can't nobody take away. And I want my kids to know that, yeah, the world does suck, but it doesn't mean that you don't have to work for what you want. It doesn't mean that it's not sweet when you have earned it and you have it. I want them to know that regardless of where you are still black and beautiful and strong. And that is something that no one can erase.
That was singer and actor Audra Boo and Jen Peterson, the former general manager at the Cloud Room. Last year, they talked with me about Jen's decision to leave Seattle and Audra's decision to stay. Audra's performing the weekend of December 8th at Velocity Dance Center on Capitol Hill. We're tweeting out a link with more information right now. That's our show for today. I'm Bill Radke. A listener named Bill just emailed us to say that was a great conversation with Claire Dieterer. I stayed in my car to listen. Thank you, Bill. And you can email us too, complaints included, record@kuow.org. Our show is put together by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel. Come back tomorrow because my guest is going to be novelist Isabel Allende. Yeah, I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.